today, but they're not here yet. We're going to be in Philippians again, chapter 2, second half of the chapter, and shouldn't have any problem finishing the chapter tonight, which is good. Gets about halfway through the quarter and about halfway through the book, so I'm still going to act like I'm really proud of myself for finishing all four chapters in 13 weeks, even though I think it was Bill Hamrick who had 43 chapters of Job or something in the same amount of time, but I'm going to act like I really accomplished something. I'm going to ask Ryan McCafferty to say a word of prayer, and then we'll go ahead and get started. So let's do just a little bit of review, since it's easy to lose track of where we are in an epistle, even a short one, over the course of a quarter. We've said that the underlying theme that we think, this is a little bit speculative, that we think is driving a lot of the epistle, is that there may be some kind of internal congregational friction in Philippi. It doesn't seem to be doctrinal. He's not correcting any doctrinal wrongdoing. He's not correcting any weird practice that they have. This isn't Corinth, where it's just a long litany of all the things they're doing wrong. At Philippi, there doesn't seem to be a lot going on, but the epistle itself just keeps coming back to joy and humility, joy and humility, which makes you think maybe Philippi was struggling to have joy and humility, which is what you would have if you were having a little congregational battle over something, and people were picking up sides and fighting like people do, whether it's in the workplace or in churches. If there's people in the room, they're going to be doing that, right? Picking up sides and fighting over minutiae that often doesn't really matter. So chapter 1, he lays the foundation of telling them how grateful he is for their work, which is an important move for a couple of reasons. One, it reminds them how important their work is. So important that it should not stop because you're fighting about it, right? So that might be kind of in the background. But also, just a pro preacher's tip, it's always nice to compliment people before you rebuke them. So if that's the goal in chapter 4, is to kind of wag his finger a little bit, it's nice in chapter 1 that he says, "You guys really have done a lot of good work, and I am truly and sincerely grateful for all that you've done." Now let's talk about humility. Maybe that may be kind of how the epistle develops, right? In chapter 2, he starts setting forward some examples of people who showed humility, who were humiliated, and then were exalted by God. Who's the first example in chapter 2? Okay, we're going to start with Jesus himself as the prime example of what humility and glory looks like. He doesn't take glory for himself. He suffers humiliation and he humbles himself. And then God does the lifting, right? God attributes to him glory, and God gives him a name above every name, and God has people confess to him. Right? God makes all that possible. So he accepts humility. God gives him glory. In the end of chapter 2 then, verses 19 through 30, the end of the chapter, he's going to give two more examples. At least one of them is a younger man that we know as Timothy. I don't know if we know anything about Epaphroditus' age. He could be another young guy like Timothy. It kind of seems like he might be, but there's no clear statement like with Timothy. Timothy's told in his own epistles, don't let anyone despise your youth. So by at least ancient standards, he was a younger man. With Epaphroditus, we don't know. But what he's doing here, I'm convinced, is to do the same thing. Both of these men, as we'll read in this passage, are known to the church at Philippi. So these aren't strangers. It's two men that they would have known, that they were familiar with. And he sets them forward as examples of people who are doing good work, who show humility, and that deserve honor and joy and glory for what they're doing, but who don't seek it themselves. Okay? So that's what we're going to look at tonight. And then, as I think I mentioned last week, this coming week, Lord willing, when we get to chapter 3, Paul finally and last will use himself as an example. Paul himself is in prison, and he's going to use himself as an example of a person who shows humility and then is receiving glory and honor because of that. Okay, but he's the last example, never first. First Jesus, then these young men who are his apprentices. Because it's kind of hard to start out by saying, you should be humble like I am, right? That's a hard leading line, isn't it? You should be more humble like me. Well, you've just ruined your humility. So he's last. He's the last example of humility in the book. So let's look at chapter 2, verses 19 through 30. If someone wants to take, let's read 19 through 24. We'll get us the Timothy section. If you want to raise your hand, 19 through 24. Jerry, thank you. Okay. I'm going to be careful the way I say this next line. I don't want to say that Paul is manipulative or anything like that. I hope you understand what I'm going to say here. But do you remember that line where Jesus tells his disciples, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves? Paul is a clever guy. Okay. So here's the way I think he's ready to make his point about Timothy. How does he introduce this point? Well, I intend to send Timothy down to you to get some news. Well, this seems safe. Now, if the preacher starts out by saying, y'all need to be more humble, immediately you put your guard up and you're ready to defend yourself. Well, I'm humble. What's wrong with you? Right? But when he starts out and he says, now I'm hoping to send young Timothy down to you. Oh, we all like Timothy. Why do we like Timothy? What is it that's so good about Timothy? Ah, let me tell you. He has all the qualities that you lack, and that's why you're fighting, right? And so this is a very clever move to set him forward as this great example in this paragraph. Let's look at some things here. First, Paul looks for firsthand news. So he's a trust Timothy to deliver the news firsthand. Presumably there are other people with Paul, but Timothy's the one he picks. If you want to know what's going on, if you want somebody you trust, Timothy's your man. For Paul. He's the one he trusts. In fact, you get that in verse 23 and 24 as well. Paul himself hopes to go, but in the meantime, Timothy. Subtly, that's saying, Timothy's my stand-in until I can get there. I don't know when I get out or if I get out, but Timothy's my stand-in. He's my right-hand man, right? So really putting a strong emphasis on the role, the trustworthiness of Timothy, the good character of Timothy. Okay, so what is it that's good about Timothy? Well, he's going to start letting you know in verse 20. What sets him apart? I have no one like him. Don't take that too literally. He's about to talk about Epaphroditus, and I assume Epaphroditus is a good fellow too, right? So, but there's nobody quite like Timothy, right? He is just a special person. He is unique in his service, okay? And we see that throughout the epistles. Timothy comes up a lot. In fact, back in chapter 1, verse 1, he's essentially the co-author or collaborator in this epistle, right? He's listed with Paul as sending the epistle. So he's very important. No one like him. Why is there no one like him? Who will be genuinely concerned for your welfare? Why am I sending Timothy? Because he's the person I can trust to actually, genuinely care for you above himself. Okay? What's the problem that we think might be going on in Philippi? People are thinking of themselves too much. That's what the previous passages have talked about. Let each esteem other better than himself. Right? Everyone's thinking of themselves too much. Why am I sending you Timothy? Because I know Timothy will put you first. Oh, that's why we like Timothy, because he's exactly the kind of person that we're supposed to be. Right? He's a humble person. He's a selfless person. Yeah, I mean, I think they have a genuine, I don't think he's having to sell him. I mean, I think they have a genuine love for Timothy, and that's why he can say all this. It's not controversial. They're going to agree. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I don't think this is a hard sell. There are some places where Paul seems to be trying to convince someone, you should listen to Timothy. This isn't one of those passages. This is a passage where I think, of course, they're going to hear Timothy. He's trying to tell them why they already like Timothy so much. What is so admirable about him? It's these qualities that you need to be emulating yourself. He can contrast them to the other people. See, I have no one like Timothy. Timothy's like this. What are the other people like? They all seek their own interests, not those of Jesus Christ. Okay? You might remember in chapter 1, he mentioned there were people preaching the gospel, but they were doing it out of envy and strife and selfish ambition and stuff like that. This may be kind of hearkening back to that, right? Timothy does it for the cause of Christ. He doesn't care about himself, everybody else. The reason I didn't send those other fellows, see the difference? In chapter 1, he can say, I'm glad they're preaching the gospel. But he's not going to pick them to send Philippi, right? They're not someone he trusts with a job. He's just glad they're preaching, right? Timothy, he actually trusts. Yeah, Jim.
The King James Version said, I have no one like-minded who will sincerely
care
for your state.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. Like-minded is a really good translation of that. I got tired of saying I don't have my Greek with me, so I finally brought it this week. But yeah, like-minded would be good. So he's setting it up for, early part of the chapter, have this mind of Christ. Timothy's like-minded, and then in chapter 3, this is also the way I think, by the way, right? So there's a consistent mind. The people you admire think like this. Jesus, Timothy, Epaphroditus, Paul. They all think like this. What does that tell you? You should think like that. Okay? That's the subtle point. He's just driving home passage after passage. Which is why, let me just make a side point, why is this in the middle of the epistle? If you're reading an epistle of Paul, when does he usually make personal references? Yeah. All the way at the end he says, and by the way, I'm sending Timothy, and by the way, Silas is here, and he says hello, and John Mark says this, and Barnabas says that. Right. All the people references are at the end. And in Philippians, it's right smack in the middle of the epistle because it's part of the teaching of the book. It's not just a, oh, by the way, point. It's part of the teaching of the book. He's holding up Timothy and Epaphroditus and saying, these are people you should imitate, and here's what's good about them. So, those are the characteristics that we see in Timothy. He's proven his worth in verse 22. Okay? He's shown himself. He doesn't have to sell Timothy to these folks. He doesn't have to say, you should learn to trust him. They already know. He's proven his worth. He was there in Philippi when Paul came the first time. So they know Timothy. Okay. What is it we like about Timothy? Ah, he thinks of the work of Christ above himself. Other things I would just throw out as just passing thoughts when I was reading this passage. The importance of mentor relationships that we really undervalue, I think. I'll say it like this. The churches of Christ have been in the funny habit of sending a guy to a school, whether it be a two-year school or a four-year school, and then he turns in his resume and he gets a job somewhere, and off you go, kid. You know, and we don't emphasize mentorship the way that we should. That's the church's job in preparing future ministers, is getting young men that have ability together with men who are currently doing the job. Paul apparently takes that very seriously. How does he describe his relationship to Timothy? Father-son relationship, right? It's a father-son relationship. He's been like a child to me. Doesn't Timothy have a father? He does, actually. It's mentioned in other places. But for Paul in the spiritual relationship, he has mentored him like a son in the faith. And you see that affection here and in several passages where Paul talks about Timothy. He mentions a father-son mentoring type relationship. And we really need that. I'm going to pick on Bill because he sat at the back. I don't want the great experience of Bill Hamrick to be lost in a generation. I want that handed down to the next group of people to learn from good men like him. And I think it's really important that we help build those mentor relationships. The other one he uses is, he served with me in the gospel. Okay. One of the ways that you establish mentoring relationship is by getting younger men experience. Okay. Timothy served right next to me. So Paul was teaching, Timothy was teaching. They worked together. And so Timothy got priceless experience, not out on his own. See, we really encourage experience. We say, go get a job, kid, go work for some church, and then he doesn't get any guidance, and he gets chewed up, spat out, and we lose a lot of young preachers that way. I can make you a list and run out the rest of the evening telling you stories of young men I know who started preaching and quit because of just not getting good guidance and getting chewed up, spit out. A lot of it their own fault, but it was their fault because they didn't know what they were doing. And it was somebody else's fault that they didn't get experience and guidance to know what they were doing. So we've been good about go get some experience. We haven't been real good about here's someone who's going to guide you. And that's what you described here. Father-son relationship, mentoring. On the other hand, he serves right next to me. See, we can be both. He's my fellow servant, he's my brother, and father-son. Right there next to me, and I guide him. And that's the relationship that builds. How do you get a person like Timothy? This is how. If you want a person like Timothy, you've got to have a relationship like Paul. You've got to have somebody guiding him and giving him some experience. I mentioned, I think last week or the week before, that someone had recently asked me, how do I know if I should be a preacher or not? And one of the things I told them, after I said don't, no. One of the things I told them was to go fill a pulpit, not as a job, but just as a fill-in somewhere. Get some experience. Because you have to preach a lot of bad sermons before you get to some good ones. And that's just the truth of it. You have to really make a fool of yourself a few times before you get to a level of competence 20 or 30 years later, hopefully. So that's part of it. Timothy was allowed to serve right next to Paul. Were there times when Paul could have done it better? You bet. But it was important that Timothy get some experience doing it next to somebody who could help him along the way. So I just would comment on that. It's one of the roles the church of late has kind of let us down on. They have turned that over to the professionals and said, get a degree, whether it's the two-year certification program at a preaching school or get a degree at a college, and that is your training. And it's just not the same as having a mentor. It makes a world of difference. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, I'm picking on preachers because it's about Timothy. But your point is, yes, that the mentor relationship is a staple of New Testament Christianity. The passage you alluded to is Titus chapter 2. So Titus, another one of these young guys, he says, as for you, teach what accords with sound doctrine. Older men are to be sober-minded, dignified, self-controlled, sound in faith and love and in steadfastness. Older women, likewise, are to be reverent in behavior, not slanderer or slaves to much wine. They are to teach what is good, and so train the young women to love their husbands and children, to be self-controlled, pure workers at home, kind and submissive to their own husbands, that the word of God may not be reviled. Likewise, urge the younger men to be self-controlled. So that's the New Testament pattern, is that the older folks are hopefully maturing into the Christians they're supposed to be, and now they are taking a role of making relationships with the younger and passing along these character traits, not just doctrine. It's not taking them out for a cup of coffee and telling them, now here's the doctrine of, right? It's building the character traits that they need to have the prudence to put into place. That's going to make a big difference. Yep. Yes. Yeah. Are you about to ask me a question I don't want to answer? Yeah. In my experience with a Christian college and their master's program, it would be very easy to come out of it as a CEO type minister. I'm not going to say that's what they push, but in the entire program, there's one homiletics course, which is how to preach a sermon. There's one course on counseling for ministers, which they compress into 1 week, which it turns out, Bill, as you know, is most of the job some weeks, is sitting with people and talking. So unless you are intentionally looking to get yourself the experience, they're not going to thrust it on you, and that's a shame. It's been one of the complaints about the program, is that at the end, there's a one-hour course requirement called ministry field study, where you're actually supposed to go out and do something and then tell them about it. I laughed about it because I was required to take the one-hour course, and I said, would you like me to turn in 52 sermons that I did this year, but whatever. But for a lot of those guys, it was the only preaching they did all their entire lives. Only ministry work of any kind they did their entire lives was that one-hour course, one semester. So, yeah, colleges have the tendency to train professionally minded people, which may or not make them good ministers. Preacher schools that are 2-year programs have a tendency to create completely unprepared people who also make bad ministers, because 2 years is just not long enough to learn what you're supposed to do. Gets you in a lot of trouble. That's my 2 cents. Yeah, you really have to do it some. You have to preach a lot of bad sermons before you get some good one. You have to give some really bad advice before you learn how to give some good advice. You have to do it poorly a few times before you get to, maybe, if you survive, doing it adequately. And yeah, there's a lot of oops in there. And with some mentorship, there's less of that. Or there's a safety net to catch you when you're about to do something really, really dumb. When I first got here to Glenpool, I would say, hey, Bill, do you have a minute or two? And then 3 hours later, he would go home to Lenora after I had picked his brain about, something I wanted to know about. And it was priceless to have that available. Now that I see him less, he's busier in the prison work. I've gotten a lot dumber that he's not as available as he used to be because he's very busy himself. But yeah, I do think, I guess to summarize, the church has passed the buck of creating leadership, true for deacons, elders, and certainly ministers, to somebody else, and it's just not a job you can outsource. I'm all for education. I think ministers should go get a degree. I think you should get as much education as they can, but at the end of the day, that has not made them a minister. And that's the difference. Yeah. Bill, you got 2 cents on that you want to throw in? Or?
Again, I have to agree with you.
Okay. Good enough. Yeah. That's right. Okay. Let's talk about Epaphroditus then with the 20 minutes we have remaining. He's an interesting character. This is one of the only places you're going to learn about Epaphroditus, so I want to spend a little more time on him. Timothy, you can read about elsewhere. Epaphroditus doesn't get a lot of paper space in your Bible. First thing we'll have to do is learn how to spell Epaphroditus. There'll be a quiz at the end. It's not a name we use a lot, for sure. Not a lot of children in America named Epaphroditus. Look at the descriptions. Let's have somebody read for us. Let's just do verse 25 for starters. Let me raise your hand who'd like to read verse 25. James, thank you. Okay. So it was necessary, it was needed to send you Epaphroditus. So right away, he is an important figure. It was necessary to send him. He didn't send him on a whim. Oh, I suppose you can go down there. He is a man put in charge of critical assignments, right? He's an important person. It was necessary to send you Epaphroditus. And how are we going to describe Epaphroditus? These are interesting terms. What's the leadoff hitter? He's my brother. So that puts him on a plane with Paul. You know, it really brings him up. It would be easy to say, let me say this. I have known professors, talking about colleges, who will introduce former students at a lectureship or something like that and say, now our speaker is one of my former students. And it's a way of saying, you know, I'm kind of here. And no matter how important he is, he's still, you know, my former student. Right. But Paul doesn't do that. Paul says, my brother. Now, I think he has a mentor relationship with him, too, but he wants him to be introduced as, he's my brother. Okay, he does the same thing to a runaway slave in the book of Philemon. He's my brother. Okay, so that's important. He's my fellow worker. Again, not my subordinate, and Paul had every right to say it, right? He's an apostle. He's the lead man here, but he doesn't say he's my subordinate. He's my gopher. He gets the coffee for Timothy and I. No, he is my fellow worker. Fellow soldier. This is one of the only places in the New Testament you'll see Paul use that language. It's a really interesting phrase, especially because of who Philippi is, what Philippi is. Philippi, we talked about the first week, is a Roman colony settled by a lot of old veteran Roman soldiers. So I assume the church there was populated, at least in part, by old Roman soldiers. So how does he describe Epaphroditus? He's my fellow soldier, not in Caesar's army, in the Lord Christ's army. And he has been in the trenches with me, right? This is not somebody who is on the sidelines watching from afar. There are probably a lot of people that said, oh yeah, I'm right there with Paul, way over here. I'm right there with Paul, but not in the dungeon so much, just, you know, in town. Epaphroditus is my fellow soldier. He's right there with me. Your messenger. Does anybody's translation have your apostle, by the way? Just curious. It is actually the word apostle. Now, he's not calling him an apostle of Jesus Christ. I'll make that clear. Okay, and the apostles of Jesus Christ are the men that Jesus sent out and that had the appropriate levels of power and authority and so forth. But the word apostle just means somebody who was sent. So the apostles of Jesus were the 12, plus Paul, who Jesus sent. Okay, he is your apostle to me. He's the one you sent. So the yes, or some of the translations have the word emissary. He's your emissary to me. He's the one you sent to represent you to me. So this is the reverse of Timothy. Timothy is who Paul sends when he can't go. When Philippi can't go to Paul, they send Epaphroditus. See, he's there, the person they trust. Why do you trust Epaphroditus so much? What's so good about him? Turns out it's all the same things that are good about Timothy. And that's the kind of point he's making. He is a minister to my need. What makes Epaphroditus great? His service. His service. He attends to the need of someone else, and that's what makes him great. Okay. So this is going to build in this point. Service and humility make people great. Take a look at the next few verses. Somebody want to read for us verses 26 through 30? Just raise your hand. 26 through 30. Jim, thank you. So a glowing resume for Epaphroditus. He is the model of selflessness. Let's take a look at this kind of point by point. Epaphroditus is in a hurry to go back to Philippi, hometown, right? He's a hometown boy. Paul says, I'm sending him back. He wants to go back. Why does he want to go back? He is distressed. Why is he distressed? Sorry? Yeah. He is distressed, and this is the same kind of language used of Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane, by the way. He is distressed not because he almost died, but because the people back home heard about it and worried about him and couldn't do anything about it. So he feels bad that they are worrying about him. Have you met that person, by the way? Once in a while you do, and they're just sick and deathly ill, and they're apologizing to you for all the trouble you went to, right? We've met those people, and that's the kind of guy Epaphroditus is. He doesn't know that it's okay to be sick and to be worried over. He says, no, I worry over Paul, right? He came to attend to a guy in prison. Nobody's supposed to fuss over me. Nobody's supposed to worry about me. You know, it's supposed to be under the radar. So he's completely selfless by instinct, right? Not just things he says, by instinct. He doesn't know he's supposed to be worried about his own health. Oh, I can't believe anybody's worried about me. Epaphroditus, you almost died. Oh, it wasn't that bad. I mean, you can hear the guy, right? It wasn't that big a deal. Do you need something to eat? Right? You can just hear the guy, right? Trying to take care of other people while they're fussing about him. And which brings us to the other point. Indeed, he was ill, near to death. Okay? I don't know if we can really understand with the marvel of modern medicine. It's good and bad, but the modern medical world has so changed our lives. The threat of illness in the ancient world, it was so easy to get something and die from it, especially while traveling. You're traveling, different places, different water, different food, different bacteria. Even now, if you travel overseas, certain parts of the world, what do they tell you? Well, you're going to get sick. It's just going to happen. If you drink the water, you're going to get sick. If you eat the food, you're going to get sick. If you breathe the air, you're going to get sick. It's a different place. Well, think of that in the ancient world, but no tetanus shots. Sorry, we're 2,000 years away from penicillin. There's just a lot of things that are not going for you in the ancient world, not to mention no sanitation, okay? So all of that, and it's so easy to get ill and deathly ill. Epaphroditus faces that with apparently a level head that he doesn't turn around and go home. That would have been maybe a smart thing to do, right? I don't know when he got sick. Did he get sick on the way there or when he got there? But there's no indication of the text that he ever became or desired to be a burden to anybody else. Quite the opposite. He was worried that he might be a burden. In fact, this is the next line. Where is this? This is verse 27. Let me see. Yeah, Paul says, verse 27, indeed he was ill, near to death, but God had mercy on him, and not only on him, but on me also, lest I should have sorrow upon sorrow. So Paul is deeply concerned for him, right? Paul is Paul himself. Another good example of selflessness. Paul is in a dungeon, worrying about Epaphroditus. Epaphroditus is on his deathbed, worried about Paul, right? This is humility in action, right? This is the way Christians are supposed to be living their lives. Completely oblivious to their own situation and completely desirous to help others. Why does he nearly die? He nearly died for the work of Christ. Okay. There are people who we might call workaholics who work themselves into an early grave or something like that, trying to get ahead, trying to make money, trying to do other things. This is not one of them. Epaphroditus is doing this all for the cause of the gospel. He's going to work himself into the grave, if need be, for the cause of the gospel. The next line is, risked his life to complete what was lacking in your service to me. That's a weird phrase to modern ears, so let me pause on that just a minute. For us, it would be really weird if I was sick and... pick on Debbie. Debbie brought me a meal. It would be weird for me to write the church a card saying, thank you that Debbie brought me that meal you owed me. Right? That would be a strange way of talking about it. In the ancient world, hospitality, especially Christian hospitality, was so important and so assumed that you felt in a person's debt if you did not offer it. Okay? You felt like you had cheated that person if you did not offer them hospitality. So the Philippian church feels indebted to offer Paul while he's in prison hospitality. And Epaphroditus is willing to risk his own life rather than let his home congregation down and allow them to come up short in terms of hospitality. It would be a dishonor to the congregation if they didn't help out Paul. So at risk of his own life, he's going to complete what was lacking in your service to me. Does that kind of make sense? It only makes sense in a hospitality kind of honor and shame culture of the ancient world. Our brains aren't even wired that way. But for them, it would be a deep shame to not help Paul. And for Epaphroditus, if he let the church down, if they weren't able to show Paul the hospitality he was owed in the world of hospitality, big deal. So he's willing to go and if need be die. Okay? Because that's a necessity to show Paul this kindness. So you get lots of just great big swelling phrases that express the humility and selflessness of Epaphroditus all the way through. Just not enough we can say about him. A couple of questions that I think are kind of interesting. Verse 27. Did God heal Epaphroditus when he was sick? I've got another follow-up question, but let's answer that one first. Did God heal Epaphroditus when he was sick? And you're looking at verse 27. So you're cheating. You're getting to my next question. Did God heal Epaphroditus according to verse 27? It's not actually a trick question. God showed mercy on him. Okay, so he doesn't use the word heal, but it's he was sick, God showed him mercy. So God healed Epaphroditus. What is interesting is the text does not tell us anything about how, which is kind of odd because you might think, again, Paul has miraculous gifts. He's healing the sick. There's a scene in Acts where just by touching an article of clothing that an apostle has touched, people were being healed. I mean, it's just, that says in the text, no one had even heard of anything like that before, and neither have we, right? I mean, it's just an absurd amount of healing power going out, right? And yet here is a person who is sick, and Paul's worried about him being sick, and he is appreciative that God shows him mercy, but there's no indication of in the text of how that might have come about. This would have been a great point if Paul had used some kind of miraculous power to say, and so I healed him. You're welcome. But he doesn't say that. He says, God showed mercy on me. Oh, that could have been miraculous. Also could not have been miraculous, right? There's no indication of how it was done. So I think that tells us a little bit about what should be the Christian expectation when it comes to our prayers for those that are sick. Paul is an apostle with apostolic power, and yet he's still not sure that Epaphroditus is going to get well, right? He says he almost died. It was an act of mercy from God that he got well. Paul doesn't say, and if God hadn't healed him, I'd have been mad at him because he owed me one, right? He doesn't say that. He says it was an act of mercy that he got well. So, on the one hand, the Bible does encourage a boldness in prayer, an expectation in prayer that God works in this world in a variety of ways, certainly beyond what we consider miracles and what we sometimes call providence. It's all providence, but it's in ways that are beyond the miraculous, is my point. But even with that, Paul, an apostle, doesn't act like he has a guarantee that a valuable, necessary servant wasn't certainly going to get well.
In that same verse, it also refers to God's mercy as not only to Epaphroditus, but to himself.
Yeah.
So he didn't have this one. Spared me sorrow upon sorrow.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it definitely, it's very reserved language. This is not the way you normally hear the Bible describe, and Paul healed somebody, right? This is very, he showed me mercy, he saved me from sorrow, you know, it was very reserved. In contrast, interesting, maybe a secondary point, Paul himself, in another passage, has a thorn in the flesh, and he prays that it would be removed, and what does God say? My grace is sufficient, which is interesting. Here, God showed me mercy, and he got well. Over there, whatever it was didn't go away, and God says, well, that's grace too. You get my grace. Right? So I guess my point is that even for a person with the apostolic authority and power like Paul, prayer is not some kind of machine where you pull the handle and something comes out. Right? That it is still done with an eye to God's will, and we can expect good things. We're told to have faith in good things. Don't pray with nothing wavering, right? But at the same time, realize that just because you want it doesn't mean it's the will of the creator of the universe. Does that sound fair, Jim? Yeah, sometimes it's, that was a terrible thing you just asked for. Yeah. I can look back in my life and think of several times when I prayed for something, and I'm very glad God just completely turned me down, that I did not get what I prayed for, because it would have been terrible, right? So I'm glad that he knows best. Yeah, we don't know this was a miracle. Yeah, for sure. No. No. I don't know if I can say what all the miracles are for. Some of them seem obvious when Christ does them to make a point. Some of them seem like acts of compassion. They probably all made a point, and they were probably all acts of compassion. Some of them may have been more one than the other. But here, there's not even an indication that there's anything miraculous going on. And yet it's called mercy, right? An act of God's mercy. Okay, I'm about to run out of time, so let me just quickly sum up. What's the big conclusion to chapter 2? Look at what we've learned. Jesus was humble and therefore received joy and honor. Look at verse 29. So receive him in the Lord with all joy and honor such men. Okay? Who gets honor? The humble servant gets honor. Jesus was humbled, he gets honored. Epaphroditus is humble, he deserves honor. Do you see a trend? In chapter 3, it's going to be Paul is humble, he deserves honor. And then in chapter 4, by the way, you folks that are fussing and fighting, if you want honor, you have to be humble. Okay? Next week, chapter 3, we'll talk about Paul, and it is a fun passage. He is lively in describing himself. Lots of fun phrases. If you have a King James Bible, it's especially lively. Baby says my time was up. That's right.
You're done.